Do you remember what you were doing on the 29th of July this year? Probably not. No, just blank faces. No, I don't remember what I was doing. It probably passed you by like any other regular Friday. You probably remained blissfully unaware that that was the day, though, when the world was supposed to end. The 29th of July this year. The Earth was to undergo what's called a polar flip. The Earth's surface would become a vacuum, causing the atmosphere to be pulled down to the ground. A rolling cloud would cover the planet. A mega quake would ensue. And then I think maybe possibly Jesus was supposed to return after that. On the 29th of July this year. But we missed it, I think. We're still here. This is, of course, according to the YouTube channel End Time Prophecies. Don't know if you spend much time looking at that. It probably doesn't matter, though, if you missed the 29th of July this year, because, don't worry, there'll be another date next year, and probably one after that, and maybe a few every year. There's always a few high-profile predictions of the end of the world as well. Perhaps you remember from a couple of years. There was a Russian peasant and a Christian mystic called Rasputin who lived in the early 1900s, late 1800s, and who predicted that the world would end on August the 23rd, 2013, many years after his own life had ended. And that was quite a big deal in 2013. I don't know if you remember that. Or the Mayan apocalypse from 2012. Yep, a few people nodding over here. That's right, 21st of December 2012. 2112, 2012, something about the numbers, you know, there's always something in there. The Earth to be destroyed by an asteroid, or maybe an alien invasion, or maybe it was a supernova, nobody really knew. Predictions of the apocalypse and the end times have been a feature of human history, really, for a very long time. And it's not just Christians who do it as well. There's Muslim predictions of the end times, there's predictions from the Jewish scriptures, there's leaders of other groups or cults perhaps, and of course there's scientific predictions about when and how the world will come to an end. Americans in particular like to attach their apocalyptic visions to political events. And we've heard a little bit of that recently too. It's not uncommon for Americans to talk about their elections as end times kind of scenarios. When Donald Trump won the presidency just a little while ago now, more than a few people joked that we're living in the end times. The Daily Show's joke, I don't know if you saw this, was that November 8th episode was a series finale of that show called America. Comments about Trump with nuclear codes and world destruction were sort of, kind of, maybe a bit of a joke, but of course, in 2012 and in 2008, comments about Barack Obama were not a joke. Trump might have been seen as a dangerous buffoon, but Obama was painted as the Antichrist. A second kind of interesting development in the way that we talk about the apocalypse or the end times these days is this. It used to be taken for granted that God would one day visit some kind of destruction on the world, but now we tend to think that we will bring that destruction on ourselves. Actually, that it's through politics or technology or environmental disaster. The catastrophe that brings about the end of the world, we imagine now, will be our own doing. Still, the end of the world is probably not common dinner table conversation for you. I don't know. It's not for me. I don't know when the last time you chatted with your friends or your family about that scenario was. And as I've been talking to people over the last few weeks, we've been talking about Advent. Many people don't know that in Advent, as well as marking the weeks and the preparation for Christmas, we're also talking about waiting for the second coming of Jesus. We remember not just his coming as a baby, but the bigger plan of God to restore all things when Jesus comes again, and to complete what is started when Jesus comes as a baby at Christmas. Most of us don't spend that much time thinking about the end of the world, probably. But when we read the Bible, we notice that the Israelites in the Old Testament and the first Christians in the New Testament, they kind of did spend a bit of time thinking about it. That Old Testament Jewish believers were waiting for God to come and do something drastic, for God to save them, for God to change things, to act in human history. And New Testament Christians thought that Jesus was coming back soon. I think, honestly, the Apostle Paul, who writes much of our New Testament scriptures, probably didn't expect that we would still be here today. But this isn't going to be a sermon on the rapture or the signs of the times or the meaning of the numbers 666 or anything like that, because the emphasis in the Bible is not on the specific details. It's not on the date or the time, the how and the when, and it's not even that detailed on the specifics of the what, of the what will happen and what exactly it will be like. Advent isn't about predicting the apocalypse. A few people might breathe a sigh of relief. So what's the future focus then meant to be about? In our reading from Romans this morning, we see that there the expectation that Paul has that Jesus is coming soon leads him to actually teach about how the Christians should be living in the present. What the Bible teaches, what Christians believe about the future is not just some kind of fantasy escapism or terrifying vision or some kind of insurance policy, but it's actually meant to be a significant driver of the way that we live now, the way that we live in the present. Christian hope for the future is a resource that shapes the present. And our passage from Isaiah chapter 11 this morning is like a vision of God's future. It describes the future that God promises for his people, not the hows and the whens, but it's an image of the nature of the place, of the characteristics of the rule of God. And it starts in verse 1 with this new leader, the shoot from Jesse. Isaiah 11 opens by saying that a shoot will spring up from Jesse. And if you've got your Bible open still to Isaiah chapter 11, you can look back at the previous chapter at the very end of chapter 10, and you'll see that it ends with a description of God cutting down a forest of trees. It's talking about God's judgment on the nation of Assyria, the Assyrians who have conquered the people of Israel and sent them into exile. God's judgment is coming for the oppressors, and it talks about the tall trees, the huge towers, the strong trunks that God will cut down. And then, at the start of chapter 11, out of this felled forest, this destroyed habitat, which includes the devastation of Israel, out of this stump, that's all that's left, will grow a new green shoot. And it will grow from the stump of the tree of Jesse. You might be sitting there thinking, what's the stump of Jesse? The reference is to Jesse, the father of King David. And so this reference does two things. Firstly, it connects this coming leader, this coming Messiah, to Israel's great family of kings, to King David, to Jesse's family, from which the king was to come. But it also separates him just a little bit as well. By going back to the roots, if you pardon the pun, the roots of the tree and the roots of the family, actually going back to Jesse and not to David, it's kind of saying this isn't just a continuation of the Davidic line, it's like a do-over of the kingship. By rolling it right back to Jesse and not to David, it's acknowledgement that the line of King David's family was not ultimately successful. They weren't enough, they failed, and so we don't need just another one of the same, we actually need something new. Someone like David, in one sense, but different. And we see in these first verses of the chapter that the key to the success of this new leader, the defining features, is his connection with the Spirit of God. This is God's chosen person, a person who walks closely with the Spirit of God, who leads with the knowledge, the wisdom, the Spirit, and the eyes and the ears of God. So this is the first characteristic of God's future that shapes our present, the person who walks in the Spirit of God. And then we see a bit about what that means. He doesn't just judge by what he sees and hears as things appear, but he knows all things and he sees beneath the surface. He sees that perspective that sees that very often the systems of this world have got it wrong. And we're reminded once again in this passage of God's concern for those who suffer and are oppressed, for the disadvantaged and the poor and the marginalised. And this is a kind of amazing picture. For those of you perhaps that have worked in community services or in the public service, it's a picture of something that feels impossible for us to achieve on our own. Justice and equity. They're easy aspirational words, but the systems that conspire against them in our world are vast and complicated. Justice and equity. What would that really take? Financial justice, equity in education, housing, job opportunities, safety for people, dignity, the end of exploitation and oppression. What about justice for the people of Syria? What would that look like? I don't know if we can even answer that question, let alone bring it about. And yet there's something in this vision that speaks so deeply to us, I think. The idea that wrongs will be made right. We know that's what should be. And this is the second characteristic of God's future. God's future that shapes our present. Justice. As we go to the third, I want you just quickly to think of an animal. Perhaps your favourite animal or any animal, doesn't matter. Just in your mind, think of an animal. And turn to a person next to you or behind you. Tell them which animal you've chosen. Tell each other which animal you've chosen. And talk about what would happen if those two animals lived together. So I wonder what happens for you and the animals that you've chosen when we put these two animals together. What if they lived together in a paddock or in a zoo? Would they be safe? Did they get along? Would one of them have some food, perhaps, and not the other? Your animals, of course, were chosen at random, and maybe they could live together quite well, maybe not. But in this next section of this chapter in Isaiah, we have this picture of animals living together. But the animals are not chosen at random. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion, and there's little children playing in there too. Many of you know that our six-year-old son loves animals, and when we talk about this passage in the Bible, he gets pretty excited. You mean you can just hang out with lions? Awesome. And snakes? He loves snakes. And I'm terrified of snakes. And to be able to play with snakes in safety? These are dangerous combinations of animals in this chapter. Well, they're dangerous for the lamb and for the kid and for the calf and the child. And the point here is not that God's future will be dangerous. It's not that lambs will have to live next to lions with no escape and no protection. That's not a very good picture of the future. The point is that these scenarios will be safe. That something will be transformed. Predators will no longer attack. Vulnerable people will be safe. The things that harm will no longer harm. The things that we fear will no longer hurt us. The nature of things will be changed. And this is a picture of safety. Verse 11 says, they shall not do evil, they will not harm nor destroy. Some people think it's also an argument for vegetarianism and perhaps that the future is a vegetarian future. We can talk about that over morning tea. It's also a picture, though, of reconciliation, because some of these pairs of animals are actually pairs of, according to the Jewish law, clean and unclean animals. So bears were unclean, cows were clean. Wolves were unclean, lambs were clean. And so the picture of these two animals together, lying down together, is actually a picture of peace that exists and community that exists between cultures and religions and peoples that would otherwise have been kept separate. It's a picture of cultural and racial harmony and reconciliation. So this is the third characteristic of God's future that shapes our present: safety and peace. I want to just change track a little bit here. This week, and you might have read about this, heard it on the radio, seen it in the news, one of our federal politicians, I won't say who, maybe I will later by accident, but I'll try not to, appeared on the radio and responded to callers. And one caller spoke about the fact that his local school was no longer singing Christian Christmas carols. And all of the Christian Christmas content had been replaced with the Happy Holidays kind of stuff. This particular federal cabinet minister who took this call responded by saying, "It makes his blood boil." This is the phrase we all love to hear: political correctness gone mad. And seeing as he was speaking of schools and teachers, he took the opportunity to criticise Australian teachers who had recently publicly protested against Australia's treatment of asylum seekers and our policy of offshore detention. This is what he said: "If they want to conduct these sort of campaigns, do it online or do it in your own time. Don't bring these views into the minds of young kids." This is about talking about refugee policy in schools. Many of the people, he said, regardless of their religious belief, would be there happy to sing Christmas carols, happy to enjoy the fact that we celebrate Christmas as a Christian society. Because the vast majority of Australian people want to hear Christmas carols, they want their kids to be brought up in a normal environment, and they don't want to be lectured by do-gooders who, frankly, don't practice what they preach. Many people have already pointed out the irony of these comments. of being outraged at the lack of Christian songs in schools at Christmas, but totally unconcerned by the human rights abuses of our policies on refugees. This federal minister wants to keep Christmas Christian by singing Christmas carols in schools, but seems entirely ignorant of the Christian imperative to welcome the alien, to care for the oppressed, to protect the vulnerable, and to seek justice. And quite frankly, to quote this person himself, it makes my blood boil. What's the point of singing Christmas carols about the birth of Jesus if we take no heed of the message of the carols or the point of Christmas? If we don't remember that Jesus and his family were refugees, if we don't remember God's heart for the vulnerable. My very favourite Christmas carol is O Holy Night. It's a beautiful, beautiful song, and it will sound beautiful when you come to our carol service tonight at 7:30 here in the church. It will be sung excellently. But the real reason I like it so much, and the reason that it endures for me as a powerful Christmas song, is these words of the second verse of the carol. The verse zooms out from the stable and the little scene of Jesus and his mother and father. It says this: truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. There was another prophet who lived around the time of Isaiah, and his name was Amos. And Amos was very, very quick to point out the hypocrisy of the religious people who made a big fuss about their religiosity but who neglected justice. People who used religion for their own ends and their power but who oppressed others. Amos wrote, "Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream." And I wonder if Amos was here in Australia today, this year at Christmas, if he might just have the very same words to say. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. So if you want to make our politicians happy this Christmas and put the Christian back into Christmas, here's how I think Isaiah and Amos and Jesus might tell us to do it. And I'll give you a clue. It doesn't include me complaining that there were no Christmas carols at my son's Christmas concert on Friday. Pursue these characteristics of God's future so that they shape our present. From Isaiah 11, be a person of God who sees and hears with the eyes and ears of God, sees below the surface, walks with the Spirit of God. Look around your neighbourhood, your street, your family, your friends. What are the needs? What are the hurts? How can you be a person of peace? Do justice. Volunteer, give money. Maybe instead of a letter to Santa, you could write a letter to your local MP talking about something that you care about. Do justice and pursue safety and peace for others. You know, normally when I read this passage in Isaiah, I think of myself in that picture of the lion and the lamb as the lamb. as the one who cries out for safety and rest. But this year I was challenged as I read this passage that perhaps I'm more like the lion. How are the ways that I live and consume and go about my life ways that hurt vulnerable people? How do I contribute to the exploitation of others with the gifts that I buy or the things that I do at Christmas, perhaps in particular? Am I the lion and not the lamb? Many of you probably do much of this already, I know. But today I want to say we do it with faith, we do it with intentionality, and we do it with the Spirit of God at work in us, in the knowledge that this is what Christmas is about, that this is Christian discipleship, and this is what Jesus came for. During Advent, we take some time to look forward to when Jesus returns. We don't know when, we don't know how, but these Advent scriptures give us a bit of a sense of the what, the vision of what God's good future will be like. And that vision should animate our living in the present. Do the things that Christ will do when he comes.